You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good morning and welcome to a discussion on democracy and power. Today is October 20th, 2008. It's 15 days before the U.S. presidential election, and early voting has begun in many states across the United States. This is Bill Vandenberg. I'm the director of a new fund at the Open Society Institute called the Democracy and Power Fund. It's a new program in the U.S. programs division here, and the Democracy and Power Fund provides funding support to organizations who are working to build a stronger movement for social justice in the United States, and also to support organizations that build power for those who don't currently have it. The Democracy and Power Fund supports organizations across the United States that conduct civic engagement and nonpartisan voter registration and voter education, organizations that build new leaders, particularly among young people across the United States, organizations that organize in communities to build power and to build bases of action to advance social change, organizations that fight for a fair and independent judiciary, and that develop ideas and policies to advance social justice and social change. So today is the first of what we hope will be an occasional but lively series of podcasts that involve organizations that OSI supports and who are doing innovative and high-impact work that give voice to perspectives that often either need amplification or that go unnoticed by policymakers and opinion shapers. We also seek to spotlight efforts that integrate community organizing, grassroots outreach, and real connections with real folks across the nation with policy change. So today's discussion will focus on the United States' economic crisis and economic downturn. And we have all read and seen on the television and over the radio and in the news and online many stories of anxiety and panic and despair and feelings of powerlessness among folks. The focus seems to have been disproportionately on Wall Street and how do we bail out banks, and less so on what is actually happening at the community level and how people are experiencing the impacts of this. Some would say that we now have a historic opportunity to reshape the economy of the United States. I don't think anybody would have predicted a year ago today that we would be taking steps to nationalize the banking industry. So many things have changed in the United States' political and economic culture. And I'm very excited to be joined by two folks who are experts in different aspects of this crisis. And I will introduce them and their organizations, and then we'll have a lively discussion. And thank you for joining us. Our first guest comes to us from the Drum Major Institute. And the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to challenging what it calls the tired orthodoxies of both the right and the left. And the goal is to achieve progressive public policy for social and economic fairness. The Drum Major Institute, or DMI, seeks to change policy by conducting research into overlooked but important social and economic issues by leveraging its strategic relationships to engage policymakers and opinion leaders in its work. And it also offers platforms to amplify the ideas of those who are working for social and economic fairness. It was originally called the Drum Major Foundation, and it has a rich legacy in the civil rights movement. It was founded by a lawyer and advisor to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the turbulent years of the civil rights movement. It was relaunched in the late 90s in 1999 by the son of William Wachtell, who was the attorney to Martin Luther King Jr. It was also relaunched by Martin Luther King III and Ambassador Andrew Young. DMI has noted on its website that conservative think tanks and foundations spent $1 billion between 1990 and 2000 in the attempt to influence public policy and public opinion. And their investment for many of those years had clearly paid off, from tax cuts that are inspired by trickle-down economics to disinvestment in public institutions to the silence that remains the norm in the face of growing poverty in our society. Conservatives and conservative think tanks have, over the last few years, really reshaped this nation. And perhaps now we're seeing a bit of a political recentering. But we're very excited to be joined here today by Mark Winston Griffith. And Mark is a senior fellow for economic justice at the Drum Major Institute. Mark is a community economic justice activist and a journalist whose articles have appeared in dozens of publications, including the New York Times, The Nation, New York Daily News, Village Voice, Spin Magazine, The Source. He's also a columnist with the Gotham Gazette, a board member of the national network called Free Speech TV, based in Denver, Colorado, and a board member of City Futures, which includes City Limits Magazine and the Center for an Urban Future. Mark has a very broad and impressive resume of community-based work, including serving as a co-director for the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, a leading economic justice advocacy group. And prior to that, he served for 12 years as the founding executive director of the Central Brooklyn Partnership, which is a grassroots economic self-determination organization. He was the founding board chair of the Central Brooklyn Federal Credit Union. So we welcome Mark.
Thank you.
And our second guest is joining us from the Industrial Areas Foundation, or IAF. And IAF is a longtime organization that is rooted in community organizing and citizen organizing and power organizing in communities across the country. And the leaders and organizers of the Industrial Areas Foundation build organizations whose primary purpose is power and the ability to act, and whose chief product is social change. The IAF is non-ideological and strictly nonpartisan, but proudly, publicly, as it says, and persistently political. The IAF builds a political base within society's rich and complex third sector, a sector of voluntary institutions that includes religious congregations, labor union locals, homeowner groups, recovery groups, parents' associations, settlement houses, immigrant groups, schools, seminaries, and others. And then these leaders use that base to compete at times or confront at times or to cooperate at times with leaders in the public and private sectors. So the IAF develops locally based organizations that use power, organize people, and organize money in effective ways. And it is present currently in 57 affiliates across the nation in 21 states, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Germany. And I'm pleased today to be joined by our guest, Mike Geekin. Mike is a Chicago native and a longtime organizer and trainer within the IAF Industrial Areas Foundation Network since, looks like, 1977, Mike. And Mike is currently based in the New York area, where he has responsibility and supervises the IAF organizations in New York City, Long Island, and New Jersey, as well as supervising organizations in Chicago, Lake, and DuPage counties in Illinois. He is the co-founder of Nehemiah Homes efforts in New York and Philadelphia, which is a housing program, which he will tell us about, that includes 2,900 homes in Brooklyn, about 1,000 homes in the South Bronx, and 130 homes in Philadelphia. Mike is a published author, including books called Seen Through Our Eyes and Going Public, which came out at Anchor Books in 2003, and has also been published, like Mark, our other guest, in a number of publications, including the Village Voice, Boston Review, New York Times, and others. So welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Bill.
So Mark and Mike, thank you very much for joining us for this first discussion on democracy and power. It comes at a pretty compelling time in our nation's history, both politically and economically. And I'm wondering if you could start out this conversation by talking about how we got to where we're at with regard to this economic crisis.
Well, I'll start, Mark,
thank you,
that's
Mike.
All right. Well, I think we may be seeing the end of the idolatry of the market sector, and that's been part of what the Drum Major Institute has studied and other people have commented on. We've come through a period where the market has dominated the governmental sector, where the government, both left and right, Democrat and Republican, has been obsequious to it, and perhaps that's ending now. And so the cost of that ending are going to be quite high, and the end isn't still here yet. It's still unfolding. But we think the blind faith in market solutions to almost everything, the loss of confidence of the governmental sector, and the good work of the third sector in some places, and the confusion in other places, has led us to where we are. And it's a time of fundamentally changing relationships and perspectives, and also a time of great opportunity.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, and I want to include within that idolatry of capital markets this promotion of, I think, consumerism and, to a certain extent, homeownerism at any cost, with little regard to the path we take there. I'm a firm believer in asset building and people having the ability to own homes. But I think what we've seen over the past few years is a championing of this, using abusive methods to get there. And what that has included is an error, a generation of abusive lending practices and abusive real estate practices that have sort of colluded over the past few years to create mortgage products that at the end of the day just were not affordable for literally millions of people. And so, you know, there are many of us, you know, sitting around this table and elsewhere who have been decrying these practices for a long time, who have said, this is going to come back to bite us, that people are not actually building equity, they're losing equity, they're losing their assets. It's actually opposite. What occurred was, I think, kind of opposite to what was originally said to be our goal. And this is now resulting, again, in millions of people looking at foreclosure. And as a result, all of the institutions that invested in these mortgage products are now suffering.
Thank you, gentlemen. What is your take on the government's response to this crisis at present and the political universe? I mean, we are squarely in the middle of a presidential election campaign, which both elevates the issue and also politicizes it to a point where responses may be forced to be immediate and not necessarily as thoughtful as necessary. Can you talk a little bit about that culture of political immediacy / expediency that we're in the midst of?
Well, you know, because the crisis isn't over yet, and we don't know the extent of it, the depth of it, the range of it, it's awfully hard to come up with final solutions to it yet, and the tendency to do so is dangerous. So there had to be some responses, and some have been made, but it's really dangerous to think there's one big solution that we're going to find now, or someone's going to find now, or someone's going to find in the near future. So that's one thing that's worrisome about the pace of the reaction and the drive to solve something before the something is defined. And then the second part of that is that we have to watch is that each region has different dynamics, different pressures, different economic situations. The Midwest is very different from the Northeast, is very different from the near South. So the expectation that one solution or one answer will meet all needs in all regions, also something to keep your eye on. There has to be some respect for the kind of social knowledge in each region, each part of the country, what their assets are, what the limitations are, what the possibilities are, and the ability of those regions to design solutions that fit them, you know, really appropriately.
What I would add to that is I really do like that phrase that you used before, Mike. You talk about idolatry. I think that idolatry of the capital markets and of, you know, by extension, sort of Wall Street, created a response that said that, you know, as soon as there were these sort of dramatic fluctuations in the stock market, that the reaction has to be sort of, I won't say exclusively, but almost exclusively around shoring up Wall Street firms and banks and the capital market. And I think that's what's been most disappointing and what's been most threatening and scary about the government's response so far is that, you know, what it sort of demonstrates about what we value and what we think sort of is the engine behind the productivity and financial health of this country is Wall Street. Whatever responses that are taken, and I agree wholeheartedly with Mike, that, you know, these things are going to have to sort of unveil over time, and it's not necessarily include national responses, but very local and regional responses that are going to deal with different realities in different areas. But the bottom line is that we're going to have to see some attention put to an investment in the public, you know, ordinary people, that something that addresses the economic situation that working families are going through and what local communities are going through. So, you know, and I'm confident that those of us around this table right now are going to be working on those kinds of solutions.
So what could that have looked like, Mark, and instead of the bailout package that we got, or in a complementary fashion to the bailout package that we got, what would that investment in the public, how could that have taken shape differently?
Well, I think it should have started with what I talked about before as being at the root of the immediate problem, which is the fact that so many mortgages are in distress. The housing market in general is tanking. Again, in general, there's been a loss of confidence in the housing market and in the individual mortgages that people have. And so I think where we should have started is there. That is, addressed this, again, this era of abusive lending that has left so many people, you know, the value of their homes underwater, first of all, and second of all, people struggling to make ends meet and struggling to avoid foreclosure. And of course, we know that when homes go into foreclosure, it has a ripple effect across the community in terms of lowering property values and lowered property taxes. So whatever response, you know, needs to happen, it needs to happen around this problem, that is helping people address what were fundamentally toxic mortgages and bad real estate practices, something that enables people to recover their assets and make whole, make good on the loans that they took out.
Mike, what are your thoughts on what another solution could have been compared to what we've got?
Well, I think I agree with Mark. We have to focus on some different institutions as well as the markets. And so these institutions are not the institutions that are generally studied at the Harvard JFK School, or the Woodrow Wilson School, or the Wharton School. And you don't get $300,000 starting jobs by working with them. One is the American High School. The American High School was one of the great engines of social mobility in the last century, from 1900 to 1975. It was a thriving, high-performing, expanding institution. There's a great new book out by Claudia Golden and Lawrence Katz about the race between education and technology, where they trace the rise of the American High School and then its plateauing and then its decline. Investing in high schools and in the education of young Americans at that age, in their skills, in their talent, in their ability, rebuilding them, making them physically habitable in places like Baltimore, as you know. People can't drink water. The water is tainted in public schools. I mean, physically, educationally. So the high school is an engine that works. That's an institution that has worked. So that would be one. A second would be living wage jobs, public or private. The living wage job is another engine of social mobility that leverages people up out of poverty and into working class and middle class status, and how they're created and where they're created is going to be critical. And the third would be ownership and equity, as Mark was saying. When we started building Nehemiah Homes in 1983 in Brooklyn, it was not a housing strategy. It was an equity strategy. Mm-hmm. And if you focused on equity, mm-hmm. you build at the lowest possible cost with quality. You charge a down payment so that people have to have a stake in their house and there's no mental rental, as my good lawyer friend Terry Flynn always talks about. You don't anticipate people paying 35, 40, or 50% of their income for their housing. You try to hit it around 20 or 25%, mm-hmm. lower if you can. So it's an equity strategy. And so those indicators, kind of social capital built in high school and community colleges, the great 45% of American mm-hmm. college students now attend community colleges, living wage work and equity with ownership, we think are three of the areas you'd focus on, and whoever the next president is should reopen the map room, which FDR used to narrate the World War II, and narrate how the nation, region by region and together, is going to focus on those kinds of indicators, those kinds of improvements year by year into future administrations.
So in the midst of all of the doom and gloom over Wall Street in recent weeks, there is a brief glimmer of hope that I saw in the New York Times, which is an article discussing mm-hmm. Nehemiah Homes.
Right.
And in particular, this is a program that you are an architect of and have helped to build since, I think you said, 1983.
Right.
And 3,900 people, I believe, mm-hmm. are homeowners mm-hmm. in Brooklyn and the Bronx here in New York mm-hmm. City. And foreclosures, I think, are something like under 10.
Low. Very low.
Talk a little bit about that. And the field of organizing has been much maligned in recent weeks. And community organizing and other forms of organizing much maligned, and this seems to be a real success story. So
well,
tell us a little bit more about it.
So we're not worried about
let's
the
talk about this
temporary
one in
maligning. it started out of the leadership of East Brooklyn congregations in Brownsville and East New York and Bushwick, and if you remember the times. In the late 70s, New York almost went bankrupt. East Brooklyn was considered beyond the pale. Mayors would come on tours from around the country to see a community that had evaporated. One mayor described it as the beginning of the end of civilization. The prevailing theories in the country were benign neglect and planned shrinkage. We're going to hear a lot about that, by the way, I think, in the future. Benign neglect. It's only benign when it's not happening to you. So this is an area where we built a great citizens organization called East Brooklyn Congregations, and leaders like Alice McCollum and Reverend Johnny Ray Youngblood and many, many others grappled with what do we do in an area where widespread abandonment, where the city's population is declining, where arts is common, where crime is common, and we put together a plan to build large numbers, critical masses of single-family owner-occupied homes called Nehemiah Homes. At the time, we were attacked from both left and right. From the market people said, why would you do that? There's not a lot of profit in a $50,000 home, now a more costly home. And people on the so-called progressive end were not pleased that we were building ownership and equity. They thought what was needed was more rental housing that could be managed, probably by them. So we got hit from both ends. But we insisted on building a house that working people could afford, including people who lived in the public housing overlooking the sites that we were building on. Half of our owners came from public housing, which uncorked public housing in New York and allow those who are making income in public housing to get a first home and allow other people to move into public housing. And it was done by an organization two-thirds of whose leaders could not afford the homes they were building. Hmm. And I've always been struck by that. The leaders fought very hard for a program only one-third of them or so could afford, because they knew this is what the market doesn't have. They knew that their children could afford it, their sons, their daughters, their cousins, their aunts, their uncles. They had a long-term vision of their self-interest, much longer than the market has, and often much longer than government has. So they, you know, we've ended up building 2,900 homes in Brooklyn and are building 1,500 more, 1,000 in the South Bronx, 770 in Baltimore, 150 in Washington, 130 in Philadelphia and elsewhere. And I think we've shown that the old-fashioned equity and ownership strategy in a central city can help rebuild it. Now, with Community Preservation Corporation, with Common Ground, with Northwest Bronx Clergy Coalition, not all of which are part of the IAF, they're mm-hmm. all great groups. Essentially, New York's been physically rebuilt. It's a remarkable, untold story. Almost 200,000 units built new or rehabbed since the late 70s. Almost every vacant lot and vacant area reconstructed. It has new problems and new challenges, but this is a great public works story that didn't start in City Hall or in any one Robert Moses type charismatic figure. It started on the ground in Washington Heights and East Brooklyn, South Bronx, and elsewhere.
Well, it's a compelling story, both for the access to equity that it has helped provide for so many folks who would not have had it otherwise. It's also a compelling story because of the kind of cyclical nature of our economy. And if you look at New York when the Ford to New York drop dead era of bailing out the city, where the city's been at in recent years, you know, there is a feeling in the United States at this time that will we be able to bounce back? Right. Or are we just kind of seeing the beginning of a long steady decline of American influence and American economic quality and economic opportunity? And Mark, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what you think of where we go from here. And some would say that, you know, looking to, you know, if you look at the media, it sometimes seems like the dominant media and political sense is that those who really created this mess mm-hmm. are now at the driver's seat in designing the solution.
Right, right.
What are your thoughts on that, and where does it go from this point?
I would agree with that, but I do think that there's a lot of pushback that's going on across the country in, you know, rooms like this, in community settings, in community-based organizations and think tanks and unions. I think what is really unique and special about this moment is that almost everything is off the table. That is, you know, who would have imagined some weeks ago that the federal government would have taken the action that it has as far as, you know, nationalizing the banks. So, you know, I think we have to prepare ourselves, excuse me, to imagine something that may be unimaginable at this moment. And so I think that, one, we're going to have to try to reframe the conversation in much the way that Mike has already. That is, you know, when we talk about how do we recover, how do we become a great nation economically again, that it has to be, the solutions have to be comprehensive. They have to go far beyond Wall Street, and they have to include public investment in all levels. And I think that what you're seeing here is this increasing consensus around the country that, yes, we are facing a deficit, but we're going to have to spend while we're in this deficit. And what we're going to have to spend on we're going to have to spend on the public in much the same way that Mike has outlined. And I think on the state and the local level, again, we're going to have to use this opportunity to bring in a new energy, to you know, to dust off, in some instances, proposals that have been made before, but just were not given the light of day because of the political moment that they were introduced in.
Anything in particular?
Well, I mean, you know, you'll hear me sort of harp on regulation a lot, and on sort of how we help people in foreclosure. One of the things I think that we need to look at is the whole sort of regulatory structure around our financial institutions. And things like, for instance, you know, the Community Reinvestment Act, for instance, is getting a lot of attention these days and is being, I think the right is trying to take, they're trying to take advantage of the opportunity and I think maybe to even preempt what they know is coming, which is, you know, progressive forces coming together and saying, look, it was the lack of regulation that got us into this position. And something like the Community Reinvestment Act, which was created in 1977, in many ways has to be rethought, because it actually did not include, it did not apply to many of the financial institutions that were making these abusive subprime loans in the first place. So, you know, it's a complete counterargument to what you're hearing, which is the Community Reinvestment Act helped create the financial crisis that we're in. Not only was that not the case, but if we had a robust Community Reinvestment Act, if we focused on, as Mike said, equity building, if we focused on protecting consumers and making sure that there was sound underwriting criteria, and that neighborhoods throughout the country were being invested in, and when I say invested in, I mean we're receiving loans that people could actually pay back, then this problem would not have existed in the first place. And I think something like a reinvented, re-envisioned Community Reinvestment Act could be a big part of that. And I bring that up because, in answer to your question, you know, for years now, many of us have been struggling to do just exactly that, reinvent the Community Reinvestment Act, and it has been blamed for so many people, by so many people on the right. Not only do we know that's not the case, but again, I think we're in a new political moment, and hopefully, you know, no matter who wins in November, there's going to be some new political leadership, and there's going to be opportunity to reframe the conversation that we've had up to now.
How do we bring more people into this conversation across the country? I mean, in some regards, the political campaign provides both a feeling of empowerment, and then it also underscores how disempowered people are in the political universe and with the power of entrenched lobbies. So Mike, I know you work on the ground in a number of neighborhoods here in the New York area and in the Chicago area, and you work with very talented organizers and community leaders and faith leaders and others. What do you hear, and how can we begin to bring about a change in the culture of either panic or despair that exists among many folks at this time?
Well, I think we're in the discussion. I mean, we can get further in and more levels, but we're in the discussion. I mean, based on our experience here in New York, I mean, we think we know what it takes to rebuild a big city. Now, will all those lessons apply to a country? Probably not, but some will.
Mm-hmm.
In our work in Baltimore and Washington, Boston, and passing the Health Care Reform Act in Massachusetts and expanding health care in Illinois, we know we're making change through the electoral cycles, through the fiscal cycles. Now, there is a new reality, and do we want to be in the discussion about how things move forward? Absolutely. And we'll do it the old-fashioned way. We'll get ourselves in. So our we only have 200 organizers in the whole country, but we have scores of thousands of leaders and a couple million people engaged.
And part of a much broader ecosystem of organizations and organizers as well that are kind of in a similar place on this issue.
Sure. So I think we're those leaders and those members are not in isolation. They feel connected. They feel engaged. They're thinking about these things. They're wondering how to approach their Senate and congressional leaders and other leaders in their states and counties. So they're all right. What I would worry about is the people who are in isolation, mm-hmm. where there is no organizing effort of any kind in their area. I get emails and calls and contacts all the time from rural places, and people say, hey, who do I talk to here? How do I get involved? Or parts of cities where we're not engaged, or maybe nobody's engaged. Mm-hmm. Who do I talk to? I think that there's an opportunity for effective organizing now in parts of the country that maybe before now people haven't been interested in, or some people locally haven't been interested in the need for it. So we're very much in the discussion. The question is, how much more in will we be? And as Mark was saying, if the same people who created the problem, Democrat and Republican, are in the room talking about the solutions, they can't possibly solve it.
Mm-hmm.
They can't possibly solve it. So there'll be a correction to that too. But that's the short-term danger. People don't think in terms of years and a decade. They think in terms of days, news cycles, maybe a week or two. That's not the right time frame for the crisis we're in. It's all wrong.
Mm-hmm. And Mark, you work in a pretty unique part of the think and action tank universe.
Mm-hmm,
and there,
mm-hmm.
there's a large constellation of think tanks and policy organizations that don't necessarily connect at the community level,
right,
as the Drum Major Institute seeks to do. What do you see as your role and your organization's role in kind of pushing some of the think tanks to be more rooted and pushing the policy direction in a more progressive way?
That's a good question. The reason I was hired, actually, is because of the experience I've had. I mean, I was not a trained economist, although it's something, I don't know, could still happen, but I sort of cut my teeth on community organizing, in running a community-based organization, in running a financial institution, in advocacy work. I've been a journalist, so I bring a lot of different kind of skills, but I think more importantly, I bring a different kind of experience and perspective than you see oftentimes in think tanks. And to your question, I think my role is going to be just that, just try to connect the ideas that are, generated in think tanks, oftentimes in isolation, and make sure that whatever ideas that DMI comes up with are not in isolation. So, for instance, last week, or about a week and a half ago, I convened a group of community organizing groups in New York City. They're working on the local level to address the whole range of social and economic justice issues. We convened a meeting around the economic crisis. And this wasn't just something that popped out of my head I wanted to do. This was in response to at least three or four different phone calls I had gotten from people saying, look, I as an organizer, or I as a head of this organization, could you help me understand, A, what's going on here, and help me make sense of the alphabet soup and not just the crisis, but the government's response to it and how it's affecting us here on the ground, but also make connections, you know, and sort of force and try to anticipate what the impact is going to be on the neighborhood, on my neighborhood, and what kinds of challenges and opportunities does this now present. So, you know, I'm not going to say that I came in with a whole handful of answers that I just threw at people. No, it was a two-way conversation. We did have an economist in the room who discussed how we got to this place, what were the economic factors that got us here. And we talked about what the impact is probably going to be in New York City on a local level. And then we discussed what possible responses could be on a local level as well, and what these challenges and opportunities actually look like. So some, you know, there were some things that came out of it, but it was clear to us that this is not a conversation, you know, that can be finished in an hour and a half, you know, or 2 hours, that this is an ongoing conversation. So as time goes on, I'm going to be having more of these conversations. I'm going to be talking to a lot of people around the city and around the country about how do we start to reframe these issues. And I'm going to be informed in the stuff that I talk about by the work that's actually going on in local communities, in conversations with IAF and IF affiliates, ACORNS, the Make the Roads by Walking, all the different organizations out there that are doing this work. I have a sort of organic and ongoing relationship and conversation with them. And so it's going to be fluid. This conversation is going to go back and forth.
Well, gentlemen, I want to say a very profound thanks for joining us for this first podcast in the Discussions on Democracy and Power series here at the Open Society Institute. I want to express thanks to Mark Winston Griffith, the Senior Fellow in Economic Justice at the Drum Major Institute for Public Policy, and Mike Geekin, a longtime organizer and leader within the Industrial Areas Foundation. This is, as I said, the first in an occasional but hopefully lively series of conversations that will follow. The next will focus on a post-election analysis of what happened in the 2008 elections. And that will come from folks working on the ground in the civic engagement field and also looking across the nation at different patterns that emerged in the election process. So, gentlemen, would you like to give any website for people to check out your organizations or any way for people to learn more?
Well, you could go to the Drum Major Institute website, which is www.drummajorinstitute.org. And I also have blogs there and a series of articles, so you can check those out, too.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark.
The IAF has a website, www.industrialareasfoundation.org.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thanks to my colleague Rachel Pecker, who's the Program Associate with the Democracy and Power Fund, for her work to set this up as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Rachel.